This is Taking Aim with
Rav Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State. Part 1, Executive Rule. At President George Bush's July 11th press conference, a significant exchange took place that received very little media attention. But what took place at this press conference was highlighted by the World Socialist website in its article, July 16th, by Joe Kay, Bush's Assertion of Executive Power, The Logic of Presidential Military Dictatorship. What do they mean by presidential military dictatorship? While there has been much in the press about the exertion of presidential prerogative, that is, presidential decree, with reference to the congressional request for documents on the firing of attorneys, there has been very little about President Bush's assertion of executive power with reference to military rule in the United States. And this is the topic for the World Socialist website. Edward Chen, who writes for Bloomberg.com, had asked President Bush at the July 11th press conference, "How hard is it for you to conduct the war without popular support? Do you ever have trouble balancing between doing what you think is the right thing and following the will of the majority of the public, which is the essence of democracy?" That's a powerful question for a member of the established press. Ralph?
Well, Bush's response was very straightforward. He emphasized the role of the military as the decisive factor, and he counterposed it to public opinion. In fact, he was quite explicit in defining a concept of presidential power that holds up the military as the critical constituency, rising above and counterposed to the American people. It was on this basis that Bush defended policies that were totally repudiated by the general population, not only in opinion polls, but in the midterm elections. And what Bush did was attributed public opposition to the war to concerns that the United States cannot succeed. And he stated, "I understand fully why people are tired of this war. The question that they have is, can we win it? I'm concerned about whether the American people are in this fight," he states. Now, what he was doing here was both dismissing and delegitimizing the overwhelming opposition to the not just the war in Iraq, but to the militarism and the aggression, the destruction of human life that defines the war in Iraq and U.S. foreign policy in its entirety. Millions of Americans hate this war, as the World Socialist website emphasizes, not because it is mismanaged, not because it may not succeed, but they perceive it as a barbaric and criminal enterprise, as an expression of a ruling group that is in crisis. Bush declared that the occupation of Iraq will continue regardless of what people say, regardless of what people think, regardless of the sentiment in the public or their desire for an opposite result. And he defended his policy by appealing directly to the military and counterposing the military in the United States to the general population. "If our troops thought I was taking a poll to decide how to conduct the war, they would be concerned, very concerned about the mission. If our troops say, well, here we are in combat, and we have a commander-in-chief who is running a focus group, in other words, politics are more important to him than safety or strategy, well, that would dispirit our troops." And then Bush declared, "Well, there are a lot of constituency in this fight." And in the list that followed, he cited the American public as but one minor constituency. He stated that the strategy of withdrawing troops may affect the polls, but it has long-term serious security consequences for the United States, and you have to make the decisions based on what you think is right, and my job is to help this country, and therefore the decisions in Iraq are aimed at enabling me to do that job. And what does he really mean by this? The security interests of the United States, he states, take precedence over the will of the American people, and he calls the public and the population in this country disparagingly and contemptuously a focus group. And of course, when Bush talks about security interests of the United States, he's not talking about the public. He's not talking about any national interest conceived in democratic terms. He is addressing the geostrategic interests of the American ruling class, which considers the establishment of hegemony in the oil-centered Middle East and in all resource-rich countries in the world as indispensable to their survival as a ruling group, central to their strategic and tactical operations, militarily, politically, and it defines the way they have to rule in this country to sustain the system.
Let's look at how the Bush administration, and particularly President Bush, have presented their policies. They rarely speak before civilian audience. Almost every major speech given by President Bush or Vice President Dick Cheney has been before a captive military audience. That is a staged presentation where you're not going to have anyone standing up and booing. Everyone there is required to applaud, to smile. These are staged events. Let's also look at what some of these statements were, aside from the ones Ralph has given, of President Bush in this July 11th press conference, when he said, quote, let the Gallup poll, referring to opinion polls, or whatever polls there are, decide the fate of the country. And then he further went on to say that he must rely upon, quote, the wisdom and judgment of military thinkers and planners, end quote. But if we look at the record of the Bush administration, particularly in reference to the war in Iraq, the war against the Iraqi people, we see that whenever top generals such as Shinseki disagreed, opposed the policy, or had other opinions, they were replaced. So, in fact, the administration doesn't rely upon the judgments of its military thinkers. It relies upon only the military thinkers who agree with the policies of the administration.
Well, the military thinkers, Maya, those who have control over the enforcement arm of American capitalism and its state apparatus, coercive power, whether applied domestically or applied internationally, constitutes, in Bush's declaration, the principal constituency. And he went on to cite, in addition to the military as the defining constituency to whom he is responsive, which is a little disingenuous because the military is at the behest of the ruling class in the United States. It's sustained by them by the funding of the state apparatus, and the state apparatus is deployed in primary relationship to Pentagon and military expenditure, which has been the case since the Great Depression, to the degree where the entire functioning of the capitalist economy is dependent upon the constant amplification of trillions of dollars to the Pentagon and the military apparatus to not just maintain imperial control over cheap labor and plentiful resources, but above all, to keep the capitalist system functioning within the United States, in a manner of speaking, because it is in a stage of rapid decay. And then, in addition to the military as such, Bush cited a third constituency, military families. I don't think they want their commander-in-chief making decisions based upon popularity. This is a conception that defines the military as a separate constituency that outweighs and indeed overrides what the public may desire, what the public may think, or the capacity of the public to in any way determine or affect policy. And of course, we're clear that he isn't talking about the cannon fodder, the working class soldiers or their families. To him, they are nothing more than objects to be deployed by a ruling establishment. In fact, the population is overwhelmingly opposed to the imperial war in Iraq. So are the soldiers in virtually equal numbers and their families. And here, the citation of the American Declaration of Independence in its defining its central grievances against George III is apposite. Quote, "He has affected to render the military independent of and superior to the civil power. Indeed, in the political and constitutional debates that ensued amongst the property-owning class within the United States, within the Americas, colonial America, Thomas Jefferson issued a warning about the dangers of a standing army and declared that a permanent military presence constitutes a danger to the democratic rights of the population in the United States." And that is the gravamen of Bush's invocation of the military as a force not only to be defined as the only important element in society to determine policy, but Bush invokes the military as a force to be deployed against the will of the American people. And this is a very deliberate formulation, and it has to be taken with all seriousness because it is meant to tell us that the American people must accept that the military will decide, and if they don't accept that, the military will impose the will of the ruling class as the dictatorship of the executive transforms itself into forms of martial law, mass detention, suspension of all rights, as all of the executive orders and the defining perspective on what will lay ahead of the American people with the pending attack on Iran and the anticipated crisis of another domestic attack like 9/11, this time involving nuclear weapons. That's what Cheney stated. "The next attack will not be with box cutters," said Cheney. "The next attack will not be with airplanes. The next attack in the United States will involve nuclear weapons." This was stated on several major occasions by Cheney, most recently at a press conference. Every time he speaks about the prospect of extending the war to Iran, he invokes the inevitability of such an attack, and all of the major spokespersons, Chertoff, the mouthpieces for the ruling class, like the cabinet members, Condoleezza Rice, the Gates, the whole apparatus of control, invokes the specter of a new 9/11 involving nuclear weapons, the predicate for emergency rule, for dictatorship, for presidential control, for defining the military as the only stable and stabilizing element within American society.
Yes, Ralph, but let's be clear that just as in the prior times when Smedley Butler, the renowned World War I Marine military figure, was asked if he would participate in a coup, actually, in the United States, and then that he exposed. Here we have a sector of the ruling class that is invoking the military, the strength and the importance of the military, but in fact it is that sector of the ruling class that is calling the shots. It's not, as you see in some countries, where a wing of the military is moving to take over in the country.
Well, yes, although in almost, I should suggest, every major situation in which military dictatorship unfolds, even when it does rule in the name of the military itself, it is on behalf of a sector of the ruling class for whom it speaks. Now, Bush is explicit in declaring as a fundamental principle that politicians cannot be allowed to determine military policy. Only generals can. Of course, as you point out, it is indeed Bush as a politician and his ruling class cohorts, neocons, that sector of the rulers that is addicted to and preemptive and permanent and expanding warfare overseas, and a generalized targeting of 60 states in an anticipation of a state of war for the next 40, 50 to 60 years. And indeed, as you indicate, they select the top generals in charge of the military to implement this policy. They replace or dismiss military officials who are allied to another faction in the class that wants to employ a policy of starving out the Iranians or using special forces to overthrow them behind the scenes, as opposed to taking responsibility for dismantling the state apparatus in Iran and utilizing the military of the United States as the instrument for achieving this.
Or even before, when it was Shinseki who was fired because he said that to go into Iraq originally, when the intention was to overwhelm with firepower the Iraqi nation, to depose, to get rid of Saddam Hussein, and then they thought there would be a swift occupation and takeover and the complete collapse of the country. They didn't expect the insurgency, which Shinseki said that this didn't make sense, and that if you were going to go into Iraq, you would need a large on-the-ground military force, which was against the policy of Donald Rumsfeld, then Secretary of Defense, who thought that everything would rely on firepower, on air power. And for that reason, Shinseki was deposed. Yes,
well,
Ralph?
Well, yes, of course. But the crisis of imperialism is that the ability to bomb people into oblivion is limited, because the total devastation of the society can unfold, but the actual on-the-ground control of the population cannot be sustained that way, and that requires an occupying army, and that is consequence that has huge ramifications for the rulers of the United States, because it depends upon huge deficit financing, trillions and trillions of dollars of indebtedness. An occupying army invariably unites the society at every level against the occupier, and above all, the endless Chinese torture for the rulers of drip by drip and drop by drop, the bloodletting for the population in Iraq, matched by the bloodletting for the cannon fodder occupying army, creates a crisis within the society, the imperialist society itself. And here you find Bush stating that a basic principle of civilian control over the military is to be overturned in the United States. It is, in fact, he states, their decision. The military commanders in chief must do, what I mean to say is that the commander in chief must do what the military wants. That's his formulation. If the president determines that the military does not want to obey the results of an election, then there's nothing that can be done. The military must decide. The military must rule. This is stated explicitly by Bush in relation to the permanent war. He says we are in a permanent war. Since 9/11, we are in a permanent war that sees no end, and we must therefore submit to the military as the determining element in how affairs are conducted in this society. This is an articulation of the fascist character of the state apparatus itself. It is a defining political critique that is being articulated here. And it's interesting that Bush's statements did not elicit a word of opposition from the Democratic Party or from the established media. Not one major newspaper reported this portion of the press conference. No significant politician did announce the extraordinary explicit attack on these basic constitutional principles of bourgeois democratic society embodied in Bush's explicit remarks. Now, the silence of the entire ruling class establishment in the face of Bush's appeals to the military as a defining and separate controlling force in American politics, of course, is not a new phenomenon. Bush, after all, seized power in the year 2000 with a stolen election, and he used invalid military ballots as an important element in that. And what's even more indicative about what is going on within this ruling class is the statement of Al Gore at the time of the stolen 2000 election. He stated, "I cannot become president without the support of the military," quote unquote. Ever since that moment, the military has been asserted as entitled to play an ever more prominent role in American political life. And the Bush administration has asserted the right to hold citizens and non-citizens in military custody indefinitely and without charges. They have created the Northern Command, which coordinates now military actions within the United States. This is the first time in the history of the country that an explicit and actual formal order has been issued for the Northern Command, the military, to control every city within, is it 100 or 200 miles of the coastline in the United States. They have therefore, this ruling class, expanded the power of the military to intervene in all domestic affairs, and the National Authorization Act passed last year to provide military funding required a specific section inserted that nullifies the Posse Comitatus Act, which had prohibited the use of the military for domestic affairs in the United States, whether with respect to natural disaster, so-called terror attacks, or, instructively, other, this is a quote, other conditions in which the president determines that domestic violence or instability has occurred to the extent that state officials cannot maintain public order. Translation, public opposition, public demonstrations, public strikes, any form of resistance, opposition, or political expression that is incompatible with military control of the society, with increased expenditure for adventures abroad, for overwhelming the resources of the society to the point where the pauperization of the society is at a scale unprecedented, the military will be brought to play to rule this country.
And, Ralph, that was a part of the John Warner Defense Appropriation Bill. It was slipped in, this overturning of the Insurrection Act, which allowed the intervention of military by presidential decree, and that had been slipped in and was approved by both houses of Congress. Another example of a presidential decree in affecting the people of the United States that has gone unnoticed happened a few days after the press conference on July 17th, and that was an executive order entitled, quote, "Blocking Property of Certain Persons Who Threaten Stabilization Efforts in Iraq." And the president can issue executive orders. Recent examples have been executive order after 2001 that Bush decreed, where he allowed for the execution of people overseas. Imagine giving the CIA the ability to execute people. And then also executive orders such as what we have here. This executive order has ramifications for the anti-war movement, although the anti-war movement is not explicitly mentioned. And I'd like to read part of it because you'll see once you hear the particulars of the executive order what we mean. It says that all property and interests in property of the following persons that are in the United States, that hereafter come within the United States, or that are or hereafter come within the possession or control of the United States persons, are blocked and may not be transferred, paid, exported, withdrawn, or otherwise dealt in. And this is a determination by the Secretary of the Treasury in consultation with the Secretary of State and the Secretary of Defense, and the Secretary of the Treasury can allow any other administration official to It can delegate the responsibility to any administration officials. And what the particulars are, one, threatening the peace or stability of Iraq or the government of Iraq, that is the government that is sustained by the United States, not the government of the Iraqi people. B, undermining efforts to promote economic reconstruction and political reform in Iraq or to provide humanitarian assistance to the Iraqi people, or to have material assisted, sponsored, or provided financial, material, logistical, or technical support for, or goods or services in support of such an act or act of violence, or any person whose property and interest in property are blocked pursuant to this order. Ralph?
Maya, look, the executive order, which follows on the press conference in which Bush formally stated in much clarifying detail that the opinion of people in the United States has no weight, that only the military can decide, and that his responsibility is to rely entirely on the military he appoints to determine policy, the executive order that follows states the following, that anyone who has committed or poses a significant risk of committing an act or acts of violence that have the purpose or effect of doing the things that you have stated, namely peace or stability, in any way prejudicing peace or stability of Iraq, that is to say military control by the United States over Iraq, to prejudice the economic and political policies of the United States in Iraq, or to have materially assisted, sponsored, or provided financial, material, logistical, or technical, or any form of support, or goods or services that in any way compromise the economic, political, and military policies of the United States, such persons will have their property and interest in property blocked. And what does that mean? That they cannot maintain bank accounts. They cannot remain in their homes. They cannot own a car. They cannot have any material possession. The prohibitions in subsection A include but are not limited to the making of any contribution or provision of funds, goods, or services to the benefit of any property, a person whose property and interest in property are have been blocked pursuant to this order. Translation, if you have a brother or a father or a friend or a political comrade or a workmate who has been deprived of their bank account, deprived of their home, deprived of their possessions by this decree, if you in any way lend them money or give them shelter or give them transportation, if you do anything to provide goods or services to the benefit of this person whose property and interest in property have been blocked, you are subsumed under the same category and become yourself a person without any right to subsist. You cannot even own clothing. That's property. You cannot own shoes, that's property. This is all defining any transaction by a United States person, I'm reading from Section 2, or within the United States, that evades or avoids or has the purpose of evading or avoiding or attempts to violate any of the prohibitions set forth in this order is in turn prohibited. And the executive order goes on to state that any such act of assisting a person who has been so defined as deprived of property constitutes a conspiracy to violate the prohibition set forth in this order and is in turn prohibited. For purposes of this order, the term person means an individual or entity, a partnership, an association, a trust, a joint venture, a corporation, a group, or a subgroup, or other organization. That means you cannot have an anti-war colleague, you cannot have an associate in the university or a student colleague who is in any way participating in your well-being, lending you something, even a hat to wear in the sun, without their being enfolded within this extraordinary draconian executive order.
This is Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State, Part 1, Executive Rule. We have been discussing recent executive order by President Bush blocking property of certain persons who threaten stabilization efforts in Iraq, which on the surface looks like something else, but can be used against the anti-war movement in the United States, if you read closely what this order is saying. And it has been an order that has not been picked up, noticed, or written about in the press, just as we were speaking about the July 11th press conference, where President Bush was explicit about saying that the opinion of the American people is not what motivates him in his actions. Let's also look at something that has received a lot of attention in the press, and that is the firing by the Attorney General's office and the influencing by the administration of who would be U.S. attorneys, the firing of 9 U.S. attorneys by the Bush administration officials, and the claim by President Bush that he has executive privilege and that his officials will not turn over their emails or their letters or even testify before Congress about what took place. In the Washington Post, Dan Egan, Amy Goldstein, July 20th, wrote an article, "Broader Privilege Claimed in the Firing. White House Says that the Hill Can't Pursue Contempt Cases." And they call it a bold new assertion of executive authority that has been presented by Bush administration officials, who say that the Justice Department will never be allowed to pursue contempt charges initiated by Congress against White House officials once the president has invoked executive privilege. Under federal law, a statutory contempt citation can be issued by either the House of Representatives or the Senate, and it must be submitted to the U.S. Attorney for the District of Columbia, quote, whose duty it shall be to bring the matter before the grand jury for its action, end quote. That is what the federal law states. But the administration officials argued that Congress has no power to force a U.S. attorney to pursue contempt charges in these cases, such as the prosecutor firings, in which the president has declared that testimony or documents are protected from release by executive privilege. So what do we mean by executive privilege, and what is the President Bush and his administration officials invoking? What is the significance of this claim? Ralph?
Well, Maya, here's what it means. The Justice Department will be ordered to defy any congressional contempt order or demand for testimony or documents or any assertion of the right of the legislature to monitor or to guide, override, or oversee the activity of the president and the executive in the United States. A U.S. attorney, and this was a quote, will not be permitted to bring contempt charges or to convene a grand jury. A U.S. attorney won't be permitted to argue against a reasoned legal opinion. No one will expect that to happen, unquote. In other words, what the executive is now asserting is that Congress has no function. And it states it has long been understood that constitutional prerogatives of the president would make it a futile and purely political act for Congress to refer contempt citations to a U.S. attorney. Mark J. Rozelle, a professor of public policy at George Mason University, called this administration declaration astonishing. It is a breathtaking view of the president's role. What this statement says is that the president's claim of executive privilege trumps all. This is a dramatic attempt to declare that Congress is an empty shell without any authority, notwithstanding the Constitution of the United States, notwithstanding the role of the legislature. The administration has declared that Congress, in essence, is defunct. In fact, what Charles Schumer, the senator from New York, stated is that the administration is hastening a constitutional crisis. And Representative Henry Waxman, the Democrat from California, said this position makes a mockery of the idea that no one is above the law. The next step would be to just disband the Justice Department, and he might have added the Congress of the United States as well.
And the reference is to the fact that Congress has requested documents from the White House Chief of Staff, Joshua B. Bolton, and also the White House Counsel, Harriet Myers, in reference to the firings of the 9 U.S. attorneys. And it's been substantiated that they were fired because they had refused to prosecute Democratic lawmakers who had opposed Republican decisions. And as the chambers have said, there's an inherent contempt of power. And it is going to be interesting to see if Congress pursues the statements that have been made by Schumer and Waxman, or if they are just talking about the fact that the president is snubbing his nose at Congress.
Well, Maya, Stanley Brand, the Democratic House counsel, stated that the administration's view, quote, turns the constitutional process on its head. They are saying that they will always place a claim of presidential privilege without any judicial determination above any congressional demand, whether for evidence or for anything else, without any basis in law. The position, he stated, is telling Congress, we control the enforcement process in the United States and we are going to thumb our nose at you. Now, Maya, that has immediate bearing upon the executive order that followed upon these declarations by Bush and his cabal in the White House. In fact, what this executive order states is that only the Secretary of State, Secretary of Defense, with the Secretary of Treasury, are authorized to take actions, including the promulgation of rules and regulations, to employ all powers granted to the president as may be necessary to carry out the purposes of this order. Now, it is a very clear declaration that it is military and arbitrary rule that will define policy in the future in the United States. And
Ralph, I think it's important to look back at the claims of executive privilege. And an important document was prepared by the Congressional Research Service, which is prepares reports for Congress on legal matters. And this was a report on presidential claims of executive privilege, history, law, practice, and recent developments. It's available on the internet. It was updated July 5th. In order to deal with the current crisis. And it's written by Morton Rosenberg, a specialist in American public law, American Law Division, and it was prepared specifically for members and committees of Congress. And the report reviews the claims of the Bush administration. It goes through the history of what took place during the administrations of John F. Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, Nixon, Ford, Carter, Reagan, Bush Sr., President Bill Clinton, and now currently with President George W. Bush. It looks at what took place, the crises that developed during the Watergate cases and the post-Watergate cases. But most of all is the conclusion at the quote, that recent appellate court rulings cast considerable doubt on the broad claims of privileges posited by the OLC, that is the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel, in the past and now by the Clement memo, end quote. And that's referring to the June 27th memo by Paul D. Clement, the Solicitor General and Acting Attorney General, in matters that dealt with the fired prosecutors, where he claimed in his memo virtual blanket immunity under executive privilege and asserted that, quote, congressional interest in investigating the replacement of U.S. attorneys clearly falls outside its core constitutional responsibilities, end quote. And the case to which he refers was never went before the judiciary, and this is a case during the Reagan administration with reference to the Environmental Protection Agency, where the Environmental Protection Agency had refused to turn over documents in with reference to the enforcement of hazardous waste laws. And what the court had said is that both the administration and Congress should actually sit down and discuss and try to mediate. And if all attempts failed, then the courts would look at the situation. But in fact, after much discussion between the EPA and congressional representatives, they came to a compromise. And so the judiciary never did have the case before it. And this is the case that is cited by the Solicitor General now. So in fact, it is a non-legal precedent.
Maya, I think we need to refer back to the press conference of Bush, in which he asserted that only the military is the constituency which can define policy or has to be respected with regard to the implementation of policy. And the and apart from the fact that Bush and Cheney rarely give any major speech except before a military audience, this is what is interesting in particular about this remarkable declaration. All the nominal political opposition within the United States, the Democrats to a person, is silent with regard to the extraordinary implications of these declarations, which is even more remarkable given the fact that this is not a threat merely directed against the public, but it is also explicitly directed against the administration's critics within the political establishment about the strategic appropriateness of launching a new war against Iran. These are policy differences within the ruling elite about the tactics for implementing policy of imperial control. The administration is hemorrhaging in its support within Congress, and yet no faction in the official debate in Washington opposes the war as such. There are deep divisions over how best to uphold the interests of U.S. imperialism. And what that means is that all factions within the ruling class, the political establishment, no matter their tactical differences, are united in their fear of the constituency of an American public opinion. And this is why this press conference, these executive orders, and these now rapidly escalating declarations of the right to rule by decree point the way towards a presidential military dictatorship in the United States. Elections have no impact on policy by this doctrine. The power of the military is the counterweight to any shift in government policy. What does that summon up to us? The Declaration of Independence. Whenever any form of government becomes destructive of the rights of the population, it is the right of the people to alter or to abolish it, and to institute new government, laying its foundation on such principles and organizing its powers in such form as shall seem most likely to affect the safety and happiness of the public. When a long train of abuses and usurpations, pursuing invariably the same object, evinces a design to reduce the people under absolute despotism, it is their right, it is their duty, to throw off such government and to provide new guards for their future security. That is the American Revolutionary's Declaration of Independence. Never has it been more apposite in our history than at this present moment.
Ralph, before we continue, I'd like to correct something I said about the purge of the U.S. attorneys. those who were fired or targeted had refused to prosecute, had been prosecuting corrupt Republican elected officials, and they had resisted demands that they mount investigations of Democratic candidates or pro-Democratic organizations on trumped-up vote fraud charges. So these are politically motivated firings, and it's been clearly established that they were politically motivated firings. And this is key in the investigation of how the hiring and firing of U.S. attorneys takes place. And it goes to the heart of what we have been discussing today in terms of control of the political process by the executive. What we have is a sector of the ruling class that determined that it was going to seize power by any means possible. This is the manipulation of the vote, the control of the vote, and then the disregard for the vote in terms of the election to Congress, whatever limited means that has in terms of the actual responsibility to the people of the United States. But still, even to that extent, the executive in this country, the Bush administration currently, has decided that it cannot allow Congress to determine policy. And this, and in effect, saying that to whatever limited extent the people of the United States have any control, have any say, that is to be completely disregarded.
It entails defining people in the United States, U.S. citizens, as enemy combatants. It entails asserting the right to use military tribunals to adjudicate people accused of anything in the United States. It asserts the right to detain people without due process, to deprive them of the right to counsel, to deny them access to evidence, to be held indefinitely without any recourse, indeterminate sentences, and the application of torture, the application of extreme isolation, the application of concentration-like camp treatment. And that underlies an article by Dave Lindorf on July 27th. Lindorf is the author, by the way, of Killing Time, an investigation into the death row case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, in which he states, martial law is now a real threat, declaring the United States a battlefield. And he states, the looming collapse of the U.S. military in Iraq, of which a number of generals and former generals have warned, is happening none too soon. The Bush-Cheney regime has been working assiduously to pave the way for a declaration of military rule such that at this point it really lacks only the pretext to trigger suspension of constitutional government. Lindorf makes the point that we have been making over many years. This has been done with the active support of the Democrats in Congress. The first step was the first authorization of use of military force in September 2001, in which the president declared that the whole world, including the United States, is a battlefield in a war, a so-called war on terror, and that therefore the presidency has extra constitutional and unitary power to ignore laws passed by Congress. In fact, as the Deputy Attorney General of Reagan, Bruce Fine, observed, this one claim that the United States is a battlefield is enough to allow this president to declare martial law. Quote, you can always declare martial law on a battlefield. All you need is a pretext like another terrorist attack inside the United States, says Bruce Fine, the Reagan Associate Deputy Attorney General. Echoing what Cheney has declared is inevitable. A nuclear attack, a new 9/11, on the United States, echoing what Brzezinski stated to the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, that this regime in power today is preparing a pretext, an attack within the United States, in order to justify an attack on Iran, who will be blamed for the event of their own creation. In fact, the Authorization for use of military force, as Lindorf points out, was immediately followed by the Patriot Act in October 2001, which basically dismantled the Bill of Rights. A campaign of massive spying on Americans by the National Security Agency, which has been declared as the right that had been prohibited, namely to surveil millions of people by the National Security Agency within the United States, conducted without warrants, conducted without judicial review. This is a policy of aimed at any who disagree with the government on any issue, not just political opponents. This is a spying process which is designed to prepare people for detention. There is a list now of no less than 325,000, quote, 100,000, 325,000, excuse me, suspected terrorists. And what does that mean, suspected terrorists? It means 325,000 people in the United States who are marked for deprivation of their rights. This is the establishment, therefore, as Lindorf defines it, as an underground government within a government through the activation of 9/11 and the continuity of government protocol, whereby heads of federal agencies moved secretly into underground bunkers working under the direction of Cheney, a government functioning outside of sight of Congress and the public for critical months. This occurred after 9/11. In the first year following 9/11, the Bush-Cheney regime began a series of programs of arrest and detention without charge. American citizens, kidnapping and torturing in a chain of gulag prisons overseas. The following year, the Attorney General of the United States, Ashcroft, began a program developing a mass network of tens of millions of citizen spies, Operation TIPS. They had support from key Democrats. It was curtailed by Congress only when conservatives got wind of the scale of the thing. But it is being expanded today. Maya?
It's expanded with the warrantless wiretaps, with the data mining by the National Security Administration. And let's go on and see what further steps have been taken. As we spoke before, the overturning of the Posse Comitatus Act of 1878, when you had, under the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act, a revision of the Insurrection Act so that it empowered the president to take control of National Guard units in 50 states, even over the objection of the governor of those states. You put this together with the exposure of the grant that was given by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers to Halliburton, the subsidiary of KBR, Inc., known for living off of the funding for building the Army bases and taking over the privatization of the Army throughout the world, but particularly in Iraq. Halliburton received a $385 million grant to build detention camps, ostensibly to confine as many as 400,000 immigrants in what was supposed to be a flood, an insurgency of immigrants coming over from Mexico. But in fact, the building of these confinement detention camps could take place with the to be used, as had been prepared long ago in Rex 84, to hold dissidents in the United States.
Maya, the Pentagon has a document dated June 1, 2007, classified top secret, which declares that a developing insurgency within the United States will require a martial law counterinsurgency campaign. This has all the ingredients, as Lindorf states explicitly, of a military takeover of the United States. Brothers and sisters, the crisis of capitalism has reached the point where the system cannot sustain itself and will not rule except through arbitrary dictatorship and military control. This is indeed the crisis of a system that confronts our population with a task that was spelled out in revolutionary documents at the foundation of this nation: the American Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the struggle to throw off foreign dominion and arbitrary rule and military control. Those are the stakes, and we will continue next week with part two of our program, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State.
You have been listening to Taking Aim with
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen. Our program today, Dictatorship and the Dysfunctional Capitalist State, Part 1, Executive Rule, was recorded on July 30th. It will be available on our website, www.takingaimradio.com, and on the WBAI website on the archive, www.wbai.org. We want to thank all of you who contributed to the WBAI fundraiser, and we will be with you next week.